Well, I want to welcome you, ladies and gentlemen, to the Commonwealth Club. This is the Psychology Forum. My name is Dr. Patrick O'Reilly. I've heard Dr. Fay speak in the past. He's a wonderful presenter, and the Commonwealth Club is remarkably honored and delighted that he agreed to speak for us. Let me tell you a little bit about him. Dr. Fay served as a police officer for over 30 years and retired in 2011. He is a clinical psychologist in private practice, working with emergency responders from numerous organizations. His specialty areas include psychological treatment for emergency responders, critical incident stress response, PTSD, and police response to persons with mental illness. He teaches crisis intervention training for numerous agencies throughout California. He's written numerous journal articles and is a member of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. He is past president of the Forensic Mental Health Association of California and the president of the First Responder Support Network. He is a frequent instructor on forensic mental health and trauma issues throughout the United States. And incidentally, Dr. Fay has won numerous awards, including the 2007 Humanitarian Award from the California Psychological Association and the 2012 Award for Outstanding Contributions to the Practice of Police and Public Psychology. He is a board certified in police and public safety psychology, so please welcome Dr. Fay.
Thank you for that introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. What I'm going to try to do is share with you my perspective of emergency responder culture and how trauma affects emergency responders. And to do that, I'm going to share with you some of my own personal experience and what I've learned over the years. It's probably hard for those in the back of the room to read this, but this was a poem that was given to me by a paramedic who had retired out on post-traumatic stress injury. But the point of the poem is about how when he responds on calls and he knows the person has died, but he can't bring himself to tell the family member that. So he pretends the person is alive and he transports them to the hospital because at the hospital it's someone else's responsibility to do the death notification. And so the title of the poem is Don't Hug Me, because that's when, you know, he meets these families at the hospital and they give them a big hug and he knows, you know, you have no idea, all I've done is lie, so I don't have to deal with your pain, I have lied. And that was a very articulate poem, and I appreciate that he allows me to use this. That's me. I worked the streets almost my entire career. I spent about 11 years working with the homeless and the mentally ill, which was a wonderful job. And I was a bike patrol officer, so that was me toward the end of my career riding my bike around San Rafael. I'm the president of something called the First Responder Support Network. And this is a program that I helped start back in 1999. One of the issues for emergency responders is, as a culture, we are very sort of unique, but we're a very isolated culture. And it's difficult if I'm suffering from a post-traumatic stress injury. And then I go to my Kaiser doctor. My Kaiser doctor says, we have a wonderful anxiety group here at Kaiser. And so then as a police officer, I go to this anxiety group. So then I'm sitting in this group with maybe someone who's in a car accident, somebody who, was robbed. And I want to talk about that triple homicide. And I want to talk about that fire where those kids were all killed. I can't talk about that stuff, so I will shut down. And what we try to do was to create a program where responders could come and talk to all of us and be surrounded by people who have been there, who can share that experience with them so that they feel safe to talk. And we've been doing this program now, since 2000. We started in 99, took us 2 years of planning to pull it together. There are only two programs like it in the world. There's ours and one on the East Coast called OnSite. And we keep growing. It's just at any given time, we have a four-month waiting list for responders from throughout the U.S., Canada, and other countries to come to attend our program. And the entire program is staffed by volunteers. Not one clinician, peer support member, chaplain gets paid for the work that they do. It's been that way since the beginning. So it mentioned it's a six-day residential program. We also have a companion program because what happened, we were helping the responder, and then a spouse came up to us, and the majority of the time it's a male responder. About 20% of the people that come through our program as responders are female. But we had a spouse come up to us and say, thanks for helping my spouse, but what about me? Do you know what it's like living with this person? So we created a program to work with the spouses. My wife is a psychologist, and she runs that program. And we started out doing it 2 days. We thought, we'll just bring the spouses in. We'll make food for them. We'll make it nice. A couple of days, they'll be out of here. And we realized we completely screwed that up, that we totally underestimated their level of traumatization. And now their program is the same length as the responder, except there are changes in what we focus on, and it's been, you know, to make it fit more appropriately for them. So I want to give you a little statistic. These are suicide versus line of duty homicides. So the way you look at this is in 2008 through 12, LODD stands for line of duty deaths. These are the total number of officers killed in the line of duty during those years. These are the officers that were killed by bad guys. So the difference is these were killed by, you know, also by, you know, traffic accidents, training accidents, something like that. And these are the suicides. So we know that in any given year, 2 to 3 times more police officers will commit suicide than will be killed by a felon. And yet in our culture, we don't talk about that very much. We don't share that information. And the attitude is always suck it up, you know, don't worry about it, you know, it's okay. So now a little bit about my story, just to sort of set the tone. When I was 18 years old, I joined the Army. I wasn't a hunter. I never shot a gun in my life until I joined the military. And I get sent to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and I'm marching around these big parade grounds down at Fort Dix. And as you're marching, you shout things like, kill, kill. For a guy that had never killed anything other than an insect, it was kind of a bizarre experience. But I realized what they were trying to do. They were trying to take this huge, diverse group of people and turn us into a fighting unit that would kill on command. In other words, if they said charge and kill those the enemy on the hill, we would do that. And to do that, they had to break through our natural resistance to doing that. And it's amazing how, at that time, I think it was an 8-week training, how in 8 weeks they can turn you into a pretty good killing machine. Ironically, you know, I thought about as we were marching around that field, I thought, when we're over, when we're done with all this, do we get to march around the other way saying, don't kill, don't kill? But that never happened. Well, I left the Army and I joined the police department. And in the police department, it was a lot of the same kind of strategy, but with a little tweak. You'd be out there doing pull-ups and, you know, and you'd be doing them and your arms would be dying, your shoulders would be dying, and they'd be screaming at you because you wanted to drop off the pull-up bar. And they'd yell at you and they'd say, if you stop doing these pull-ups, you're going to stop on the street and a suspect will kill you. Don't stop. So we learned, okay, keep pulling, pull through the pain, doesn't matter, keep doing pull-ups. There was a hill, I remember, we called it Cardiac Hill, which was really steep, and we'd be running up this hill over and over again. At some point, you know, running up and down the hill, you're just getting ready to throw up because it's just killing you. And they'd be yelling, if you stop now, you'll stop in the field and you're going to die. So this message kept getting droned in on us. You know, again, don't stop, don't stop. There are people that will try to kill you. So what I learned was that there are people out there that, if given the opportunity, would try to kill a police officer. But the problem is you don't know who those people are. I don't know if it's that person I'm making the traffic stop. I don't know if I will ever run into somebody that would want to kill me or if it's on the next call. And so somehow you have to take that knowledge and put it away somewhere and try to carry that with you. And what I believed and what I learned was that no matter what, at the end of the shift, I will go home. And, you know, our family always had, we had these little rituals where as I would leave to work, they'd say, stay safe. And I'd say, don't worry, I will. And there was just this silly little ritual that everybody participated in as a way of sort of dealing with the fact that maybe I won't actually be able to stay safe. Police officers live in a world of possibilities. In the world, there are things that are impossible to happen. There are times it could happen and there are things that will happen. And police live somewhere in between it could and it will. You can't live in impossible. Anything is possible. You know, I mean, just look at the events over the last few weeks. It's possible for someone to get an automatic or semi-automatic rifle and walk into a school. If we lived over here, we'd be a threat. We'd be a risk, an officer safety risk. So we have to maintain a certain level of paranoia in order to survive. The rest of the world gets to live, well, that can't possibly happen here. And then if it does, then we get to say, wow, it did happen. I guess it could happen again, but it's not for sure it will happen. It might happen. So when I teach therapists about working with cops, one of the things I give them is a hypothetical question. And the hypothetical question is this. Suppose on the day you graduated from college, graduated from graduate school, you were approached by a detective in your local jurisdiction. And the detective came up to you and said, I have some information I need to share with you. And what that is we don't know when, but we're pretty sure at some point in your career, one of your patients is going to try to kill you. Now, we don't know when they're going to try to kill you. We don't actually even know who this person is, but we absolutely believe this could happen. Now, here's the other part to this. What we don't want you to do is you have to remain empathic to every client you see. You can't let on to any of those clients that you're worried that they might try to kill you. You have to act, you know, treat each of them fine. And then you can't take this home to your family. Don't go home to your family and say, I had this client today. It scared the heck out of me. I was afraid that this client might try to hurt me. You got to, you know, put that away. Don't talk about it. Leave it at work. When you come home from work, you don't talk about it with your family. They don't need to hear this story. That's police work. And try doing that for 30 years. And then let me know how you are as a therapist. It would be a really difficult thing to handle as a therapist. You know, a few weeks ago, actually, I had this experience where I was talking to an insurance company, one of my favorite pastimes, and I was trying to convince them to pay for a client to come through the trauma retreat. And so the person on the other end of the line had a checklist to try to see if this person qualified, and she said, well, has this person experienced a traumatic event? And I said, well, yes, they have. And she said, well, what is it? So I started telling her about a particularly horrific event, and she stopped me about 2 seconds into it and said, I don't want to hear about this. That's enough. We'll just say he has a traumatic event. And what struck me about that was, first of all, the traumatic event did not happen to me. So I'm not giving it to her directly. You know, I'm not giving her with all the emotion attached to it. I'm giving it to her third hand. And so she, and it's just, I'm giving it to her in a very clinical way. And she could not stand to hear the details that I was telling her. That officer did not have the opportunity to say, that's enough. I don't want to go here. That scene's too horrific. I can't walk in on that thing. I'm going to think about this thing the rest of my life if I see this. That officer had no choice. He had to respond. He had to go to that incident, and she had to stay in that incident. In this case, he had to stay in that incident until it was resolved. So every day I would meet people at their worst, and the world began to look like two different groups. There were victims and there were suspects. And as I learned, you know, today's victims are tomorrow's suspects. It just, that's the world that we live in. And you become very jaded in the world. And you start seeing it as very much an us against them culture because that's the way it's presented to you. So to survive in the environment, I learned to shut down because if I cried at a sad call, that would not work. My coworkers wouldn't like it. The person I'm trying to help wouldn't like it. If I got scared at a scary call, well, that wouldn't work either. And even though some of these calls made me feel that way, you wouldn't know it because I wouldn't show you. The first call I went on as a police officer, it was a man had gotten on the roof of a building and took a suicide swan dive off of about a seven-story, eight-story building. I'd never seen anybody do that before. And it was kind of fascinating to me. And so I'm just kind of looking at this going, wow. And I absentmindedly made a comment to my training officer that wow, I had no idea the brain looked so much like sweet and sour pork. Well, where do you think he took me to dinner that night? Of course, he took me to a Chinese restaurant. And what he didn't know was he was doing a brilliant psychological intervention. Because what could have happened was I could have said, wow, every time I think about sweet and sour pork, I think about this guy doing a swan dive. So I got to stop eating Chinese food. I got to stop going past Chinese restaurants. Even the smell of Chinese food could make me nauseous. What he did by forcing me to confront it in a funny way was I got over a phobia that actually never developed. But the other call bothered me more, and I put that up there to remind me of it. It was a call of a woman who had been carjacked back in it was like early 80s. And what happened was she got carjacked, driven to a very bad neighborhood where she was sexually assaulted in the front seat of her car while her two children sat in the back seat of the car and watched it. And I took the report from her at the hospital, and I remember thinking, I should be feeling something more about this. This is horrific. I mean, there should be something more happening in me about that, some empathy, something. And I couldn't find it. It wasn't there. And I remember thinking, that's not like me. This is not who I am. But I never could get to it. And I don't remember who the woman is. I wouldn't recognize her if she was sitting in this room. But if I ever had a chance to see her again, I would like to apologize to her for not showing empathy during that call. But you change. And that leads us to this thing called the emergency responder paradox. A good friend of mine, Al Benner, who's a retired, now unfortunately passed away a few years ago, San Francisco cop, who was one of the first cop docs, which is a cop that got his doctorate in psychology, came up with this. And there are a lot of words here, but what it basically says is this. To function in this job, we have to shut down, suppress our emotions like fear, whatever else is out there, revulsion, anything else. We have to do whatever we can to not experience those emotions. Because if we do experience those things, it's going to invite hesitancy. It's going to cause us to be put into a place that, you know, it's not safe for us to respond. It's not safe for us to act in this way. Well, you practice this over and over again, you become a victim of your own success. You become really good at not feeling, really good at shutting down emotions. And when these, this is the part I will read, when these same normal and appropriate emotion surface and personal relationships, we automatically shut down and wonder why over time that the people we care about the most complain that we are aloof, cold, and uncommunicative. And that is the process that happens over time. So what made me an effective police officer had the same effect or had the effect of detaching me from my feelings and from pushing me away from my family. So I want to talk a little bit about emergency responder traits, our beliefs, and our vulnerabilities. First of all, we're problem solvers. You got a problem, call a police officer. There's we don't say this to police officers when we're trying to do an intake for them for the retreat, but it would save a lot of time if we said, just can you tell me about your absent narcissistic alcoholic father? Because it just cuts through all the nonsense and we just can move right along. Now, there's a reason we don't say that, obviously, but think about it. You know, I'm a member of that club. But, you know, when I was an intern, I was talking to a client who had traumatic brain injury, very volatile client. I'm doing therapy at a community mental health program, and he's screaming and yelling and all this stuff, and I hear these quiet knocks on the door. So I get up and I open the door, and there are two supervisors standing there, and they're saying, are you okay? I'm like, yeah, why? They said, he was screaming. I'm like, oh, yeah, he was. You know, if you grow up with it, it makes you really good at handling it. So we like to say, like, the job, you know, we don't choose the job chooses us. That it, you know, it fits for us so we can manage this. So we become problem solvers. I was talking to a responder the other day. Her mother had cancer and was going to die of terminal cancer. But she can't let go of it because she's convinced that it was her job to save her mother. Her mother had cancer. Her job was to solve that problem, find the help, get it done so her mother would not die of cancer. Now, it's crazy thinking. All the doctors were saying, your mom's dying. She has terminal cancer. There's nothing you can do. She's beating herself up. We're action-oriented. We don't like sitting around. If you know, you're sitting in a coffee shop having a cup of coffee with a couple other cops when a call comes out of a man with a gun, it's everybody smiles and runs out the door because now this is something fun we get to go do. That's the way we think. We want to maintain clarity and effectiveness under stress. We don't want to think about, you know, no matter how crazy it gets, we get focused. We can look at what's going on. We can concentrate on this. We want to be able to control our environment and ourselves so that, you know, we get out there. That's what you pay us to do, to show up and control. You don't dial 911 when things are under control. You dial 911 when things are out of control. And we want to believe that people are better off because we were there. We want to believe that we can effectively control people in crisis. No matter what, we can come in and we can control you. And we're not supposed to be affected by gruesome events. Now, I don't know what this picture is about. I don't know if this child is alive or the story. But what I do know is, can you imagine being that firefighter, carrying that child, and now you have to go home to dinner with your family. You have to go home and talk and be normal and not talk about what happened at work that day and put this aside. That's the paradox. The paradox is that firefighter can do that. He can suppress or she can suppress that emotion and shove it down, but then has to go home and now be normal. And that's hard to do. A friend of mine told me this story recently. he was on a call. It was a pretty bad child abuse call. Child was really beaten severely. And he was really upset because he wanted to catch the suspect who was this child's father. He really wanted to catch him, and the guy got away, and he was very angry. You know, if he could have caught the suspect, he would have been very pleased to do so. But anyway, he gets home, and he walks in the door, and he's confronted by his 10-year-old son, who says to him, "Dad, you brought home the wrong ice cream." And he wanted to turn to his son and say, "I brought home the wrong ice cream." You know, and this launch into him, like, you know, let's talk about wrong ice cream. I'm going to tell you about wrong ice cream. You know, just really, you know, and then he realized, oh, no, this is not my son's problem. This is my problem. So he had to turn around and walk out the door, go for a little walk, and then come back home before he was better able to come in and deal with his son. And when I talked to him, I said, isn't it great that your son's biggest problem is you brought home the wrong ice cream? That's exactly what a 10-year-old should be worried about. Not that his father beats him up so bad that he needs to be hospitalized. We have this expectation that we're going to have a positive outcome on regardless of the circumstances. We'll show up, we'll fix it, we'll make it good. Well, you know, sometimes that doesn't happen. Sometimes you show up, you can't make it better. You know, I think of the those poor responders or everybody involved in the Newtown shooting, and those cops have got to be thinking, if I had gotten there 30 seconds sooner, if I had, X, whatever it is, and yet that didn't happen. So they could not make something positive out of that. And we get paid to do things that other people hate us for. Writing tickets, things like that. We always joke with firefighters, that they're the ones everybody loves, and then we're the ones that people hate. And you have the absolute necessity to remain under emotional and physical control. So in these two photos, whether you're diving under the ice to rescue a child, or you're doing mouth-to-mouth on a child, on an infant, how do you maintain that kind of control? You know, I had an interesting experience years ago. I did CPR on a very small child. And what happened was afterwards, I couldn't get the child's smell out of my nose. I couldn't get the smell out of my mind. And I would smell this child constantly for days. And it was so troubling to me that I went to a drugstore and I bought this nasal wash. And I thought, I must have inhaled some vapors or some fibers from this child that must be stuck in my nose. And I tried washing them out of my nose so that I wouldn't smell this kid anymore. And of course, it wasn't until years later that I figured out it had nothing to do with that. It was all psychological. But I didn't know that at the time. But that's how intense these calls can get. And sometimes the call is just screwed from the moment you get it. And you can't prevent the tragedy. You can't change the circumstances. And you have to live with sort of this lack of power over the call. And you're forced to confront and see many aspects of life that other people would rather not know existed. And you can't share these experiences outside the culture. A friend of mine told me a great story of, he was a new officer, and these are those gloves that we use, the blue gloves that we put on out there. And when they first came out with these gloves, they had that white powder in it. And that white powder was to dry your hands out so they wouldn't sweat. Well, he was sensitive to the white powder, and so his hands cracked, his skin cracked from it. Well, he went home, and his wife, he'd been recently married, and his wife talks to him and says, "Well, how come your hands are cracked?" And he said, "Well, because I have to wear these gloves." And she said, "Why do you have to wear the gloves?" And he said, "Well, I have to search people." And she said, "Well, I know that, but why do you have to wear the gloves?" And he said, "Well, a lot of these people are pretty filthy." She said, "Well, what do you mean?" And he said, "Well, they're covered in their own feces. They've urinated on themselves. They haven't showered or bathed in weeks or longer. It's pretty disgusting." And she said, "Well, I had no idea you had to touch people like that." So I thought, okay, that's kind of interesting. He just kind of put that in the back of his mind. Well, a few weeks later, he goes on a call of a hanging, where a person had hung themselves and been hanging out outside for a period of time. Now, he's out there, and he's talking to the coroner. And he asked the coroner, he's like trying to stay, when you're on a call like that, that's pretty gruesome. You stay focused on, what's the science behind this or something. You really try to hone in on it. And so he asked the coroner, he said, "How long do you think the person's been here?" And the coroner said, "Oh, about a week." And he said, "Well, how do you know that?" And the coroner said, "It's easy. You count the generations of maggots. You know how long it takes for maggot generations to go. You count those. And then, if you have three generations and it's a day and a half, it gives you a good estimate of how long this person's been dead." So I thought, great. He goes home, sits down to dinner with his wife, and his wife says, "Honey, anything interesting happen at work today?" And he said, "No, nothing happened at work today." And he said, though, the part that was very moving, he said, that was the first time I lied to her. And he said, and then it got easier. At that point, then he knew what he knew the boundary. He knew what he could not tell her, because she was like so surprised about the gloves and who he had to touch that he knew he could never share this story. And all the other stories that then come up, he started shutting down, because there was no place to take that unless you took it to the other cops. And that also generally involved drinking alcohol. So why do we believe these things? Well, we believe them because if we didn't believe them, we couldn't do our job. There's a guy named Daniel Rudfassi, wrote a book, and he calls it adaptive dissociation. It's not that we don't think bad things can happen, but what happens is we pretend they can't happen. And that, you know, as silly as it sounds, that works until it doesn't work. At some point, our ability to deny reality fails. And it generally fails in interesting ways. It'll fail because it can either fail because you're on a call that is so, you just can't pretend this was going to work out well. You know, I did have a call like that where I had a suspect point a gun directly at me. And fortunately, he chose to kill himself at that moment and not kill me. But it was hard for me to deny that he had me. I mean, I couldn't deny it. I mean, if he wanted to kill me, he could have. I'm grateful he didn't. But it also happens, you go on a call and it's a traffic accident and you look in the back seat of the car and there's a kid wearing the same pajamas your kid was wearing. Or you go on a call and there's this mom who looks a lot like your mom. Now these calls start breaking through. And it generally happens, you know, as you become more of a veteran officer. You know, you have an armor and the armor works. And then it slowly stops working. Cracks start developing in the armor. And these calls start coming in. And all of a sudden, now they're starting to bother you. And now you're trying to figure out, how do I get them to stop bothering me? So you try doing things. You know, you go work harder, faster, better, we call it. You know, you just throw yourself into the work. Drinking, very important part of police culture. You know, it's not helpful, but it's acceptable. You know, if I can't sleep at night, I know so many cops that have nightmares. And so what they'll do, rather than experiencing the nightmares, they will drink until they pass out and pray that the nightmares don't happen during that passed out phase. And then, you know, actually, alcohol is not a very effective sleep medication. But we believe these things, and we have to believe we can control people in crisis. We have to believe we'll affect a positive outcome, because if we didn't believe it, why would we even show up? Why would we even respond on a call if we believe we couldn't have a positive outcome on this? So, time-wise, okay. So I want to also just share a step back for a second and just share an experience that happened when I was our inability to share this stuff outside of the responder culture. I was I had arrested a man in San Rafael who was a drunk, new guy in town, and San Rafael's not that big, so we all know who all the drunks are in town. And but this was a new guy, and I'd never seen him before. And I said to him, who are you and why are you here? And he says to me, well, he's from Cincinnati. I go, wow, Cincinnati. What brings you, you know, a homeless, drunk guy, what brings you to San Rafael? And he said, well, I'm here because I have two goals left in life. And I said, okay, great. What are your goals? And he said, I want to see the ocean and I want to commit suicide. So in police humor, what I said was, have you considered the Golden Gate Bridge? You can accomplish both at the same time. Now, some of you might be horrified at that comment, but it was pretty funny in the police culture. But you go outside the police culture and you tell that joke, it falls over pretty flat. But that's how part of our functioning is, by using humor as a way of getting through events that we can't otherwise tell jokes about. Now, you know, when I was interviewed recently because of what happened over in Newtown, and I said, you know, here's the problem with calls involving children. We have several coping strategies. One is we tell a joke. But you can't tell a joke about a kid. You know, that's just a boundary that just you can't go over. We then like to blame the victim. Now, by that I mean, you know, so you have, I remember responding on a call where it was what we call a triple fatal car crash. And so you had these three dead people in this car. But you look inside the car and there was all this alcohol and everything. And so my thought was, you know what? If you drink and drive, you get into a crash, it's not my fault. You know, it's not my responsibility. That's blaming the victim. And we also then develop an irrational expectation that we could rescue people, particularly around children, that if somehow I had gotten there a little bit sooner, a little bit faster, I could have saved this person. Well, unfortunately, those don't always work out. And so when I think about children calls, you look at those coping strategies, and then when those coping strategies start to fail, then you're left with the horror of the event. And when you're left with the horror of the event, then how do you cope with it? What do you do with it? What are the, you know, I always encourage responders to exercise and stay connected. But what they do is they isolate, they become depressed, and they become exhausted. And when you get those three symptoms, when you see that isolation, depression, and exhaustion develop, then they're well on their way to a post-traumatic stress injury. The other thing that's interesting for PTSD with responders is there are different kinds of trauma. And so there's one kind that's like acute trauma, where you go along and it's a bad event, and then the event is over. Acute trauma is actually a single acute traumatic event is actually the easiest one to treat as a psychologist, because it has a clear beginning and a clear end. Then you have chronic, which is ongoing trauma, and then you have what I call cumulative stress, a cumulative trauma. And cumulative trauma is a combination of small events, big events. And the weird thing that happens with cumulative trauma is the last event doesn't have to be a big event. In fact, most of the time, the last event is nothing. It's a small incident. So you have this, and you have all these other events, and then you have that last event, which is a car accident, let's say. And this is one where I remember talking to a CHP officer who responds on a call. It's a car accident, and in this car accident, there's this kid that's wearing the same tennis shoes. And the kid wasn't killed. It was just, you know, a small child was injured, but nothing terrible. But had the same tennis shoes that his child wore. And so now he goes home, and he wakes up the next morning, and he's crying. He wakes up the next morning, he's having panic attacks. And he's like, I don't understand this. Nothing bad happened yesterday. And I remember talking to him and saying, well, what do you think? What's going on? He said, I don't get it. Nothing bad happened. And he said, you know, I've been to dozens of fatals. Why would this one bother me? And that was, he missed the whole point, of course. It's because you've been to dozens of fatals. This is that last one, that one extra fatal that put you over the edge. And that's the effect of cumulative stress. It's that one, that grain of sand, whatever it is, breaks the camel's back, however you want to say it. But it's that one last piece that puts that person over the edge. And then everything comes flooding back. And the other thing that happens, of course, happens with anybody in trauma, is events from the past connect to current events. So if as a child you grew up in a family where you experienced helplessness, and here you are 30 years later, a cop responding to Newtown, and you experience helplessness in Newtown, the helplessness you experience in Newtown will connect to the helplessness you experienced as a child, and it connects in a very powerful way. And often it's so powerful it overwhelms you, and you don't even understand how is this connection being made, like why is this happening, and you don't even recognize the connection. And we refer to that as the tsunami of emotion, where when you think of a tsunami, what gives a tsunami the power, if you look at it and say, oh, it's so powerful because it crashed on the beach, that's nothing. That's just where it hit the beach. What gives it its power is the earthquake that happened 100 miles out into the ocean. It's the same thing with these emotions. What makes that call so powerful isn't that call. It's everything that happened to you past that now has come forward and caught up to you now and finally gets you. So if a responder is listening to this, what's my message? You did what you needed to do to survive the event, and now you need to make sure that you can survive the psychological part. We put a lot of effort into training police officers how to shoot their weapon, how to use their baton, all this officer safety stuff. But less than 2% of the officers in the country have had any training on psychological stress. Know anything about PTSD. Most officers wouldn't recognize PTSD if it walked into the room and sat down next to them. Most don't believe that it exists. That it's just something you make up so you can get a workers' comp claim or something like that. I have a client I was working with recently who went to the retreat, and when he went to the retreat, all the clients sleep in the same room, and so he's feeling bad because he can't sleep at night, which is a very common symptom. And so he's sitting with the other clients, and he says to them, "Look, I'm sorry, guys, but I don't sleep well at night. And so I'm probably going to be getting up quite a few times at night." And they all started laughing and said, "Oh, we get up all the time also. How many times do you get up?" And everybody started telling a joke. And that's when he said, that's when I knew PTSD was real. Because up to now, he thought he was making this all up. that this was about him. And now, by being with other people that were experiencing, people he could trust, people who he couldn't say, oh, you know, you're just a weakling, you know, people he had respect for, then he was able to say, now I knew I had PTSD. So remember that suppressing reactions, despite what's being seen, is a first responder strength. But our strengths can be the other side of our weaknesses, or as we like to say, our weaknesses are our strengths misapplied. My ability to not show emotion when I'm out on a call absolutely is a strength. My inability to show emotion at home is a weakness. My ability on a call to use my voice and what we call command presence, and I can have a fight and I can just walk up there and by just projecting my voice in a strong way, get people to stop fighting, absolutely a strength. I go home and do that with my children, that's not a strength. So what we have to learn is how do we put our strength and our and how do we leave our power and our things that work for us, how do we leave those at work, and how do we come home and become a mom and a dad again? A few thoughts about what keeps responders from responding to treatment. One is incident envy. And incident envy is not, I wish I had your incident. I wish I was involved in a shooting. I wish I had this. Incident envy is my event wasn't big enough for me to get help. There are a lot of people out there that have had a lot worse events than I have, and they deserve to get the help more than I do. We have to, this is like almost universal. Remember we had a responder from London, a Bobby, who had been stabbed, and her partner had been stabbed to death, and she had been stabbed. And I remember when we finally got her out there, she said she didn't think she deserved to be there because she wasn't involved in a shooting. And like to me, that's like crazy-making thinking, but that's this idea of this incident envy. And by the way, the number one call that we see people, responders come, the number one category of calls is kid calls. More than shootings, more than anything else. It's calls involving children get to responders more than anything else. Which makes sense because, you know, their vulnerability. The myth of uniqueness. You know, I'm really screwed up, but I'm the only one that's really screwed up. And we give out a little button at the retreat that says JFU on it. And it's just messed up, but you could put the word in there and sort of figure it out. But they wear it as a badge of honor. It's like, you got this honorably. You got here because you put yourself at risk, and you got symptoms because you put yourself at risk, but you did this honorably, and you deserve to be here. You wear that pin with pride. And you judge your insides by other people's outsides. So what happens is you go on a bad call. The next day you come into work. And you come into work and you go up to the other guy involved in the call and you say to that person, hey, how you doing? The standard issued response is, fine, how are you? Fine, good, okay. Now everybody's lying, but nobody knows they're lying. Everybody's, you know, I'm looking at the other officer who last night went home and got drunk, you know, kicked the dog, yelled at the cat, whatever, you know, but he came in and he's fine. So now I'm looking at him and I'm saying, wow, he's fine. I had a horrible night last night. I had all these dreams. I mean, it's really bad, but I must be really screwed up. So now I believe that I am less than the other officer because I'm judging my insides by their outside. So now I start worrying, if you find out about me, if you find out how screwed up I am, you're going to kick me off the island. Because the only way you can rely on me is to trust that I'm going to be there for you. And if you find out that I actually sobbed on the way home last night on this call, then, you know, how can I trust that you would be there for me? How can I trust that you would be there to help? So, or that I would be there to help. You know, responders really have a tough time with emotion. And just a quick example, I was on a call where a woman had died. She was an elderly woman. While it was sad, it wasn't traumatic. You know, she woke up in bed, and as she woke up, she looked at her husband and said something incomprehensible and just fell over and had a massive heart attack and was probably dead by the time she hit the bed. And so I'm there, I'm taking the report, and it's not that big a deal, but I walk outside because the family showed up. I wanted to give them time alone. And as I walk outside, standing outside is a firefighter. And he's walking around in circles in front of the house. And I'm looking at him, and I'm looking over about 20 feet, 30 feet to my right, and here are these other firefighters, and they're staring at this guy walking around in circles. And I'm thinking, my first thought was they got into a fight. Some guy got into a fight out here, and that's why they're not talking to each other. And then as the guy completes the circle, he comes back to me what I see is he's crying. So I'm thinking, wow, something's weird here. So I walk up to him and I go, are you okay? What's, you know, what's happening? What's going on? Well, it turned out his mom died. He's just back to work from his funeral and all that for his mom. And so now his first call of all things is an elderly woman dying. And of course, what is he thinking about? His mother. He's thinking about his father who's home alone now, doesn't have the mom. And he's, of course, personalizing this call with this dad. But the part which is normal, that's a totally normal reaction. The part that was so intriguing to me was all his friends and colleagues who have known this guy for years could not approach him and ask him for help or ask him, do you need help? Can we support you? Because he was showing an emotion, they backed off. They didn't know what to do about it. And, you know, we refer to that as what I try to, when I use that story, I tell people, think about it. There's a code in police work called 1199. 1199 is the world has gone to hell. Get everybody here and get here right now. It's the highest priority call, at least in our department. The other departments use different codes, but it's the highest priority call. And it doesn't matter if I get on the radio and I say, I've got, you know, half of Al-Qaeda is here shooting at me. You know, everybody's got, you know, bazookas and automatic weapons, 1199. Every cop that hears that will respond without hesitation. But if you see an officer with an emotion, you're afraid to respond and you're afraid to help. And we call that the silent 1199. That officer isn't on the radio shouting, but he's shouting nonetheless. And what can you do to show up? That's when it's important for you to show up and for you to help. We carry our history with us. I tell our responders that, you know, we're all born with a backpack, and it's a magical, invisible backpack. And in this backpack, we get rocks. And if you grew up in a great childhood, then you become, you know, a responder. You have a very light backpack. But if you grow up in a childhood that's not so great, you start collecting rocks. Well, the problem is you go into police work, and I don't know what your backpack looks like. You don't know what mine looks like, and we're all pretending we don't have backpacks. And then we start going through police work, and we start collecting more and more rocks. Well, police work or emergency responder work is a marathon. You know, I can put on a pretty heavy backpack with rocks, and I can sprint 100 yards. I might not do a great job at it, but I could do it. I cannot run a marathon with a backpack full of rocks. The trick to surviving an emergency responder career is learning how to take rocks out of your backpack. And whether, I'm not saying it has to be with therapy, but it can be with therapy. It can be with chaplains. It can be with friends. It can be through any number of spiritual practices. Lots of ways to take backpacks out. I mean, rocks out of your backpack. But you gotta be a rock unpacker in order to survive the career. And when cops come to the program, our trauma retreat, we give them two rocks. And we ask them to write on those two rocks, what are the two biggest rocks in their backpack? And we've seen about 600 clients now, so we have a large pile of rocks. And if you want to see something emotional, what we do is we give this to them on the second day, the start of the second day, they get a rock. And we don't ask them to explain what the rocks mean. We never ask them about what they put on the rock. And then on the last day, we give them the last part before, as part of our graduation, we give them the rocks back. And then we say to them, you know, we take them down to where all these other responders have put their rocks. And it's this pile of, you know, like 4 or 5 feet round of rocks. And we say, you can put your rock down here if you want to let go of it, or you can choose to hold on to it. It's your choice. And you want to see emotion as these cops are standing there holding these rocks and firefighters, and they're trying to figure out, you know, can I put this down? And some put it down like lovingly almost, you know, or really lovingly. They put it down. It's like, you know, be at rest, and others throw their rocks down, like, get out of my life. I don't want you in my life anymore. And this is an example of those rocks. You know, you can see Caesar and Eric, Vietnam, public humiliation, death in the aftermath, kids, Spanish Creek. I don't know what those stories are. All I know is these were rocks that we helped people unpack. So our goal at the program is always to reduce the impact of critical events. We want to help people recover. And, you know, if any, by any chance, if there's a therapist listening to this message that wants to help out, and we're always interested in having people contact us to see if, you know, you think you might work with us and it might be a good match. So I think it's right on time, 6 o'clock. So I just want to say thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks. And I don't know if questions or anywhere. Yes, ma'am.
So does the program work by self-reporting?
Referrals to the program come a variety of different ways. Most of the time it is the spouse who says, you get help or I'm leaving. That's the majority. Number one, self-identification. And then number two is people that have gone through the program are finding other people who are like they were, and they're telling them, you need to come through this program and get them help. Departments still are not very good at sending people. It's protected, yeah, because we operate under, it's not the police department's confidentiality. We don't belong to the police department. We're a nonprofit organization, so it's under California Psychological Association or California law. So unless it's ongoing child abuse, you know, elder abuse, things like that, we don't report it. And cops have told us things that have been illegal, and or firefighters, and it's like, no, that's confidential. We don't disclose any of that information. Yes, ma'am. Well, you know, Vietnam was a great way of forwarding the knowledge about PTSD. Now Iran and Iraq are doing the same. I think there's a lot of research going on around it. I think we're just seeing it more and more. There's good treatments that are out there. I think treatment resources are greatly underfunded. It's hard to find people that are qualified to provide the treatment, particularly to find a good psychiatrist that can provide treatment for PTSD is difficult. And there's still a tremendous amount of stigma. They're changing the diagnosis, and it's coming this year. What they call the DSM-5 is coming out, and it'll be changing the diagnosis. I hope they change the title from post-traumatic stress disorder to post-traumatic stress injury. I don't know if they're going to do that because it truly is an injury. That's the only diagnosis in the DSM where something has to happen to you for you to get it. You know, any other diagnosis, depression, schizophrenia, can just happen to you. You don't have to have something happen. PTSD, something bad has to happen to you. So in my mind, that's really an injury. And I think if we call it an injury, then we'll actually open up the door for people to get treatment. Soldiers, you know, veterans, people like that. Sir, or ma'am. Yeah, you know, of course I speak out about it. I don't have any control over the DSM committee, you know, what they do. They haven't called me yet for some reason. I don't know. I changed my number, but, you know, there's not much I can do, but what I do is I go out and I speak to lots of cops and firefighters and I say, think of it as an injury. And what generally happens is sometime, groups of cops, it's an interesting experience because when you teach, I love teaching mental health workers. I'm teaching a class on PTSD tomorrow morning to a group of mental health workers. What I know is I can have like 3 PowerPoint slides and the rest is questions because they're going to be really interactive. For cops, I can teach 8 hours and get not a single question. That's just the culture. So, but what happens in that when I teach this, generally nobody asks anything, but I can look around the room and so I'll often make a comment up front. I do a whole thing on PTSD, and I'll say, if in my presentation you see yourself, then get help. You know, and that you deserve to get better. That you survived whatever happened to you, you survived. Now survive the psychological part. And generally what happens is afterwards a couple of guys kind of linger around in the corners waiting for people to leave the room and they'll come up and talk. But it's still a hard sell. I wish I could say it was easy, but it's not. Police officers are, at least in California, most of this country, but in California for sure, police officers are mandated to have a psychological test before they can be hired. And more departments, fire departments are doing it, but it's not mandatory for fire departments, but more are doing it. We can do a sort of a pre and post. I mean, we know what they were like when they got hired, and we can look at what they're like 10 years from now. But there's no ongoing testing that's required, and of course, I think any union would fight that testing. Because, you know, if they do the test and they say, guess what, you're not qualified to be a cop, you know, you're psychologically unfit, well, now what happens? now you just lost your job, so it becomes very problematic. But, sir. That's a great question. You know, I think it would be open to them, and particularly if you're talking to their friends that, you know, these folks that are police officers, and when you're there, don't accept that when you know they've been on a bad call and you're a good enough friend, don't accept, "I'm fine, thanks, how are you?" That, you know, that's nonsense. You know, a good friend would say, "Okay, good, that was the issue, answer, excellent, thank you, now tell me what's going on." And then, you know, work your way under. I think just by being available, giving them somebody they can talk to and tell this to is important. Great question. Absolutely. Also, a very good question. Well, you know, obviously I focus on emergency responder culture, but I don't know if there are any nurses in the room, but nurses, man, you guys are tough. You know, that nurses have a strong way. They can really shut down, and it's very hard sometimes to connect with them. I think it's similar, you know, the idea of detachment is similar. A nurse has to do the same thing. If you're working in a cardiac ICU unit, you better be detached from what you're doing, you know, because I want you to be professional if you're working on me. But then where do you put this? And I think it's all about support. My hope is, you know, I'm not a nurse. I haven't worked in a nursing environment. My hope is, and I tend to think that often within some cultures, it's okay to be more compassionate. It's okay to show emotion. My thought is that within nursing, within a group, perhaps it's better you can do that. Some cultures, it's less acceptable. So within police work, within fire work, fire services, it's not okay to show emotion. But, you know, I also remember doing a debriefing for a hospital after a particularly bad event. And I remember this one nurse just broke down and ran out of the room. And so we went out and followed her out and talked to her. And she said, "I'm just going back to work." And she just shut down. And you just knew that this was not resolved. You know, there was all this unresolved stuff going on inside this woman, and there was nothing we could do to help her because she wouldn't let us in. I think the more you can do about education, the more you can do for any culture, being there and showing them, here are ideas, try this, having peer support programs. I'm going to be helping a program that works with dying, it's not a hospice, but working with people who are dying. I'm going to help them develop a peer support program, because the people you can hear this from, the people that can call you on it, are the people that are doing it also. You know, I can't go to some cardiac surgeon and say, "Oh, this is what's going on. I've never been a cardiac surgeon." But another cardiac surgeon can go and confront that person and say, "Hey, you know, you're not doing okay. You know, you're different now." So I think everybody has to take some responsibility for within whatever culture they work to help other, to call other people on their issues when they see it and to try to encourage them to get help. Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the connection. The challenge becomes is when spouses don't want to hear the stories. You know, that's the difficult piece of it. But you know, absolutely, the more you can stay connected to your family, the stronger, the more resilient you will be as a police officer. I also encourage officers and responders, and particularly police officers, to have friends outside of police work. Because if you get a group of cops together, I mean, within 5 minutes, we're all talking about, did you hear that call the other day? And we're all trying to up the next guy on the call. "Well, you think that was a bad call. You should have seen the one I was on." And I said, there are a lot of really nice people out there, and you got to, like, get together with them, you know, whether it's through church or whatever, you know, your son's Boy Scouts, it doesn't matter, but connect with people outside of the culture, because that will help you remember that they're actually 99% of the world are really nice people. And we just happen to deal with that 1% that isn't so nice. But the spouse is the first line. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and of course we constantly run into ER nurses who always deal with them, you know, in the work. You know, and actually we get a few nurses come to our program, but man, you guys are tough. Yeah, you are a tough group to break into. I know. Right. Absolutely. You know, in fact, you know, something happened bad on bed number 7. Okay, well, bed number 8 needs you right now, so you got to move over to bed number 8. That's right. Yeah, it's a tough job. Absolutely. Yeah, and it's, you know, the thing that I think that you don't know what's coming in next, which I think is part of it. You know, if you can predict it, then you can prepare for it. But you don't know what's coming in next, so it's hard to be psychologically prepared for it. And then you have to kind of roll with this, and then you can't just stop. Now you have to still, your shift isn't over. You have to go on and take on the next patient. It's not easy. Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. We do scholarships. It costs $3,000 for the week, which covers all the treatment and room and board. We're getting more departments are starting to pay for it. San Francisco PD is one of the departments that starts to pay for it, that started to do that. Then others have come on board, CHP, California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. But then we always get these calls from folks that, you know, we forget in California, we actually is screwed up as sometimes workers' comp can be, it's better than a lot of states. And so we get calls from responders who, you know, somewhere where, who, you know, the department has completely dropped the ball. They don't recognize PTSD or psychological injury as work-related, and they have no funding, and they're on SSI or SSDI, so they're getting their $1,200 a month or whatever SSDI is paying, and they're desperate to come to the program. So we do scholarships for quite a few folks. And we also have, as I mentioned, the SOS program, because if you have, which is significant others and spouses, so that if you have a responder spouse that needs help, have them call us. And we, that is free. We've been able to raise money through scholarships. Seroptimus is our primary donator, and so they give us the funding that covers the cost of that program. And so we have been able to do this for quite a few years now, just seeing spouses and significant others for free. Yes, ma'am. Yes, that's our website. Currently, we are in Inverness, but we just purchased a home out in Napa County. And so if anybody wants to help us, we have the money to buy the home, but we don't have the money to furnish it. So if people want to help with that, we're certainly always looking forward, would appreciate that. We have time for one more question if anybody has it. Or, sir. That's a darn good question. Well, and sometimes you are. You know, I do believe that the job chooses us. You know, that when, that you just are good at certain things. I'm good at chaos. You know, I mean, I just am. And so it allows me to, it just seemed, I knew I wanted to be a cop when I was 5 years old, and I never varied from it. And I think that I don't know, personally, it just was, I never grew out of wanting to be a cop. First time I saw Dragnet in black and white, whatever, a few years ago, that was it. I was sold. And I never met Joe Friday, but I loved it, you know, and I just became a cop. So, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of different motivations, but I do believe that deep down it's a desire to help. And it's a desire to help people that cannot help themselves, that you can go in and you can establish control in an event that is out of control, bring order to chaos, and in doing so, you make the world a little bit better. Unfortunately, what happens in doing that, you become so jaded by what you see that often you lose that original motivation. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.